Hi and welcome to the new USSR, the Urbane Society for Skeptical Romantics. My name is Luigi Funesti Sordido and I'm the founding secretary and sole member of the new USSR. And if you believe that, you're obviously not as skeptical as you should be. Anyway, my plan for this particular podcast is to talk about things skeptical and things romantic, and hopefully the combination will lead to some kind of idea of urbanity, perhaps. My aim is to talk about three things in each podcast, a subject in each area. Something sciencey, promoting an interesting development in science. Something skeptical, a bit of a critique, and something romantic in the broadest sense of the word. So we'll see how we go. Now, before I say anything about science, I must point out that I'm not a science graduate. I've undertaken no formal studies in science, and my background, if anything, is an arts background. I do have an interest in science which has developed gradually over the years, and I'm hoping that I can make sense of these things, perhaps from a lay perspective, maybe in a communicative way, better than some scientists can. I don't know. But I'm going to also make this skeptical podcast a little bit less sciencey than some of the others, although, you know, as I say, I love science and I'm very keen to promote it. But hopefully we'll be looking at some other rather different and, you know, interesting sort of shite. Okay. Today's sciencey story is about genetics and Australia. It's good to get something about Australia in here. And anthropology, evolution, and the Out of Africa thesis, and our attempt to fine-tune that particular thesis. I read about this in Cosmos magazine, wonderful Australian science magazine, and it concerns research published back in September last year, describing the first sequenced genome of an Australian Aboriginal. This was done from a lock of hair, just under 100 year old lock of hair of a Western Australian Aboriginal man, and this was compared with the genome of Asians, Africans, Europeans, and the indications were that our Australian was descended from an earlier wave of dispersal or expansion from that of the other groups about 64 to 70,000 years ago. And this is very interesting because it suggests that there were at least two waves of dispersal of humans from Africa, and possibly more. Now, the genome, like the genome of modern Europeans and Asians, shows some limited interbreeding with Neanderthals, and, this was an interesting find, the recently discovered and sequenced Denisovans, so they interbred with the Denisovans. And no modern Southeast Asian populations have been shown to have any Denisovan DNA. Of course, the Denisovans, by the way, were recently discovered and sequenced from a finger in a cave in Siberia, and that genome was that finger was between 30 and 50,000 years old. And it may be that these people, the Denisovans, died out after the wave that brought Aboriginal people to Australia, and before the wave, which may have been the last wave, that brought what we might call modern Europeans, what have been called the Cro-Magnons. I don't know if they still call it that. But it's worth noting that in this context, that the only people before this that we know to have interbred with Denisovans were the people of Papua New Guinea. And so that suggests that maybe Denisovans once inhabited the region of Australia. The important part of this finding really is the idea of multiple waves, well, at least two waves of people coming out of Africa. So we're starting to get a finer picture of the Out of Africa story. what's interesting also in Cosmos, I was reading that they've developed a much faster and much cheaper way of sequencing genomes, which is going to probably be marketable soon. And so we're going to get all of this information from lots and lots of different people, and we're going to find out if there were subgroups that might have had more interaction with Neanderthals, with Denisovans, and so on. And we're going to get a much clearer and a much more interesting picture in the future. So this is a really interesting area to keep up with. Okay, now to the skeptical part of the show. And I'm going to start with a soft target, an easy target, easy pickings for the first show, focusing on one Joe Ratzinger. Joe Ratzinger is an 84-year-old cross-dressing celibate male who finds himself the head of a major religion, and as such feels the need to lecture people about morality. They have a word for it, in fact it's called pontificating. Joe frocked up recently for the annual New Year's address to the world, presumably, and took aim at gay marriage, which he described as a serious threat to the family and to humanity as a whole. Now, there wasn't much in the way of detail, but the gist of Joe's argument was that marriage between a man and a woman is a natural state of affairs for the engendering of offspring, and any other kind of relation which wasn't going to be engendering such offspring in a natural way was really illegitimate. So naturalism got a big Guernsey in this speech, so I want to focus on that aspect of it. The trouble with marriage is that it's rather more useful than natural. Joe believes that what is natural is what is designed for us by a supernatural being, which presents quite a knotty little metaphysical problem, but let's leave that aside. Marriage isn't natural in the way that houses aren't natural, but both are very useful. In order for us to breed and multiply, we needed social ties and bonds to help us bring up our children. We also needed shelter from the elements and from predators. So marriages are to ties and bonds, much as houses are to shelter. The first social ties for breeding weren't marriages, and the first shelters were not houses. Both are formalizations of something we've always needed to survive and thrive. So marriages, like houses, are our own creations. We develop them, we own them, and we can make them in any way we want to, or break them, as the case may be. They don't have to be for bringing up children. They can serve a whole range of purposes, just as houses can be. They can be for single people, couples, extended families, whole multitudes. They're simply arrangements for making the best of situations, and that includes being experimental, being temporary, being changeable, being traditional. I don't see anything particularly moral or immoral about marriage as such. There can be cruelty and neglect in marriage, but that isn't the fault of marriage, though it could be the fault of certain perceptions of marriage, a resentment or hostility about being beholden to a certain precept of marriage. And then, of course, there are loads, usually female, who are forced into marriages and trapped within them, without ever being given any rights to ownership. So there are problems with marriage, and Joe Ratzinger addresses none of them. Instead, he vehemently attacks homosexuals for wanting to formalize their love and support for each other. Of all the issues facing our world, he picks on this again and again and again. He's simply being preposterous, as well as grotesquely inhumane. I think it's a healthy thing to laugh at Ratzinger and his cronies, but we should remember that his speeches do lead directly to the rants of some of his underlings and fellow believers in Africa and Latin America, and of course in the USA. Persecution will feel sanctioned and horrible suffering and deaths will inevitably result. Do we laugh, or do we cry, or do we act? Do we ignore him, or do we do something about him? Freedom of speech isn't and shouldn't be unconditional. There are places where hate speech is considered a crime. Of course, Ratzinger will always use the discourse of love, but he's actually fostering fear, hatred, and contempt. You dirty Ratzinger. Now, for the romantic part of the program, I'm going to keep to a subject the Catholic Church is even more obsessed about than I am: sexual relations. Not human sexual relations, though, but the sexual behaviour of a species which many of us have been romanticising and rhapsodising over for years: bonobos. Now, for those who aren't aware, bonobos, along with their very close relatives, the chimpanzees, are our closest living relatives. In fact, they're both so close to us that some have argued that they belong to the genus Homo rather than Pan. The bonobo's scientific title is Pan Paniscus. Bonobos weren't identified as a separate species, rather amazingly, until the late 20s, early 30s. In fact, they weren't fully recognized until the 40s, and the name bonobo was adopted in the 50s, so they haven't existed in the human consciousness for very long, and this was no doubt due to their physical similarity to chimps. They live in one specific area in Africa, namely along the southern banks of the Congo River, in what's now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Chimps live on the northern side, and it's speculated that the two species were differentiated when the river was formed between 1.5 and 2 million years ago. Recent DNA evidence suggests that the split between the two species became effective less than a million years ago, which I don't think contradicts the earlier speculation, because it would have taken time for substantive differences to emerge. Neither chimps nor bonobos are keen swimmers, so that would have made the river barrier quite an effective one. Bonobo numbers are around 50,000 in the wild. They're an endangered species, like so many primate species these days, but with relative peace and stability reigning in the Congo in recent years, and substantial efforts by conservationists and others to create a very large reserve for bonobos in that region, their immediate future looks a bit brighter than it has done. But what has really caused a stir about bonobos is their sexual behaviour. They are very sexualized. Old or young, male or female, they're doing it almost all the time. Full-blown face-to-face sex, oral sex, tongue kissing, mutual masturbation, you name it, they do it, with constantly changing partners, male to male, female to female, all permutations are permissible. Just on that subject, same-sex sexual behaviour has now been documented as taking place in some 450 species observed so far, and rising, no doubt. I wonder what the Vatican thinks of that. But then, we're not animals. That's what the Vatican's response would be. Try to get the Pope to admit that humans are animals, and it would be like trying to get him to swallow poison, or to participate in a debate. You would probably rather die. Anyway, why all the sexual excitement? Well, it seems to have evolved in order to enhance group bonding and to assuage feelings and curb aggression. And if so, it certainly works. Though they do have their squabbles, bonobos are far less aggressive than the chimps on the nasty side of the river, and less aggressive than other primates in general. The phenomenon has been dubbed "make love, not war," and it certainly appeals to our hippie romantic side. But not only that, there might just be signs that we're evolving that way ourselves, at least in certain parts of the world. In his most recent book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, and in various talks he's been giving for some years now, Steven Pinker has provided lots of evidence to support his argument that human society has become progressively less violent, with the 20th century proving the least violent of any previous century. This might seem counterintuitive, given two world wars, the mass murders under Stalin and Mao Zedong, and the Cambodian, Rwandan and other genocides. But on a per capita basis, the evidence stands up. The way we view warfare today is far more negative than at any time in our history, for various reasons, one of which is that we have far more to lose than to gain by engaging in it. This wasn't always the case. But there are other ways in which we might just be going the way of the bonobo. Bonobo society is matriarchal. In spite of the females being like female chimps and female humans, only about 75-80% of the size of the males. They appear to have achieved this through sticking together in groups, ganging up on the males, and thus dominating them. Group female solidarity is maintained through female-to-female sexual activity. Do we see any signs of this in human behaviour? Yes, in a small way. Women in the West have more purchasing power and therefore more power than ever before. They've competed successfully in many highly paid areas of the workforce. Female lawyers now outnumber males, and there's a very substantial proportion of female doctors, journalists, architects, academics, and so forth. Young women emerging into the workforce in today's more affluent societies have higher expectations and a greater sense of self-confidence and value than ever before. Many of them, perhaps sadly, don't recognize themselves as feminists because they associate feminism with ancient battles and antagonisms, especially in the sexual arena. Nevertheless, they represent a new kind of female identity, a kind of girl power, which is collective and brash, and sometimes rather intimidating to men, especially those of an old-school type. There are signs of bonobo-style subcultures happening today, I would contend, and I think it's absolutely fascinating. Okay, that's all from Luigi Funesti Sordido for this week. Until next time, be urbane, be romantic, but above all, be sceptical. See you soon.